Thomas Jefferson has long been viewed as a paradoxical figure. After all, the principal author of the Declaration of Independence, which promoted liberty for all, owned 600 slaves over his lifetime. A new book, Master of the Mountain, challenges the long-held perception of Thomas Jefferson as a reluctant slaveholder. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, a conversation with the author of this controversial book. Later in the show, a biography of Jefferson's favorite daughter reveals just how ordinary her plantation life could be.
Well, there's this one great letter where she's writing to Jefferson, and Jefferson is in Washington. He's president. And the last paragraph is like, oh, well, I'm teaching so-and-so their lessons, and I'm helping, you know, this kid learn how to cook, and I'm planning the meals for the day, and I'm de-lousing Jeff, and I mean, all of these things. And one of the things that Martha said about when she got married, I got married, and then right away I was thrust into housekeeping.
But first, Henry Winsick is author of Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. The book is generating public debate over the legacy of our third president. The Founding Father has long been thought of as a reluctant and benevolent slaveholder, but Winsick's book is challenging that notion. Henry, how did your understanding of Thomas Jefferson's attitudes and actions regarding slaves and slavery change in the course of researching your book?
I started out with the attitude that most historians seem to have, that Jefferson was born into a slave system where slavery was generally accepted and unquestioned morally and legally, and that as he grew older, he felt more and more entrapped by the system and that he could not throw it off. But my research led me to documents that changed all of that, because I found that instead of slavery being a burdensome system, that it actually was an extremely profitable one, and that Jefferson exulted at the profits that that this system brought him.
Couldn't he exult in the profits but still find it impossible to end it?
No, because he had numerous opportunities to free his slaves if he wanted to. In 1782, the Virginia legislature passed a liberal manumission law, which for the first time allowed slave owners to free their slaves at will. Instead of freeing slaves, Jefferson gave them away to his heirs and relatives.
While you say that there was a law that would have permitted the release of slaves, weren't there other encumbrances that would have kept him from doing it? The fierceness of the attitudes of his compatriots, maybe, who also had slaves? You know, there are things that in your time you can't do.
Well, a lot of people in his time and in his place did free their slaves. The most notable example of that is his neighbor Edward Coles, who wrote to Jefferson and begged him to get out in front of the emancipation movement and to write a plan for beginning to free the slaves in Virginia. Jefferson said he didn't want to do it. And Cole said that he himself was going to free his slaves, and Jefferson urged him not to do that either. When Lafayette visited Monticello in 1824, he reiterated his protests to Jefferson that Jefferson had not yet freed his slaves. And Jefferson's answer essentially was, not yet. He ceased making public statements about slavery sometime in the 1780s. And after that, all of his pronouncements about his determination to free his slaves and his determination to end slavery were written privately as responses to abolitionists and other progressives who came to him and said, "You must take the lead in this movement." He would then brush them off with some high-flown rhetoric about the blacks having rights, but we can't grant them their rights until they leave the country and go back to Africa, which was a fantasy. And he called this version of his correspondence his soft answers, the things that he would say to people he just wanted to put off.
what has been the prevailing modern historical perspective on Jefferson regarding slavery?
Oh, the modern perspective, I think, is rather simple, that he was trapped in the institution, that he was trapped by debt, by convention. I don't think he was trapped. He wasn't trapped when he was squirming under the monarchy and took forceful steps to throw off the regime of King George. And once you have overthrown a monarchy, there's really nothing that you can't do. And in terms of his running a benevolent plantation, that doesn't stand up to scrutiny either. It really was a much more violent place than we have been led to believe.
So the violence toward slaves or the harshness toward slaves came from overseers?
It came from overseers, but Jefferson knew all about it. He was informed of it. It went on for decades. And Jefferson found a way to distance himself from the nasty side of plantation management. He would issue very clear orders to overseers, as he did in one case when he said, "Some people require a vigor of discipline to make them do reasonable work." And he denounced overseers as a bunch of brutish men who had what he called a spirit of domination. But as much as he denounced these brutes, he repeatedly hired men like that to get things done because they were very tough guys, they had no misgivings, and they could make the machine run.
Jefferson is a hero the world over because of many things, but primarily because of his ringing words, "All men are created equal." Did he mean slaves when he said all men?
Yes. When he wrote the Declaration, he included black people among the people who held those inalienable rights.
How do we know he meant black people?
Jefferson said in a document that was circulated to the Virginia House of Burgesses that if only America could stop the slave trade, we could proceed to the enfranchisement of the slaves that we have. So here we see the young, fiery radical proposing a truly radical emancipation. He said that we will make these people citizens.
Was Jefferson any different than the other founding fathers from Virginia who were slave owners?
It's very hard to make generalizations. I mean, the obvious comparison is between Jefferson and George Washington, who freed his slaves.
But only in his will.
Well, yes and no. I mean, for 10 years before his death, he was struggling to find a way to free his slaves. Washington was thwarted because he kept running into people like Jefferson. When Washington was in office, he was so appalled by the business of slavery, the selling of little girls on the open market in the federal city by his own relatives, that he went secretly to one of his in-laws and said, "Let's you and I get together and we will put in force a plan to free all the slaves at Mount Vernon. What we will do is we will set them free, but we won't lose the labor because we will hire them right back on wages or as sharecroppers." And his in-law refused to do it. He did not want to give up the capital value of the slaves.
There came to be a time when you noticed that Jefferson's attitude about slavery changed. What was this period in his life?
You can begin to notice the process of a change taking place in the 1780s. At the end of the Revolution, he begins writing what became known as Notes on the State of Virginia, where he sets down the racial observations and theories that we today find so repugnant. His suggestion that black women in Africa copulated with apes, that the black people are inferior in their rationality. And he was really going about the business of creating an image of the black person as other. And this is startling because several of his slaves had just risked their lives to save Jefferson's life and property during the Revolution. And he seems to have completely discounted that. In 1782 and 83, he could see that the revolutionary fervor for human rights that could have led to an emancipation movement was burning out. George Washington noticed that phenomenon also. He said that spirit of liberty, which would have sacrificed anything to its attainment at the beginning of this contest, meaning the war, has long since burned out, and it is not the public interest but the private interest that moves mankind, and Americans can no longer prove to be an exception. And he was speaking specifically about a plan to free slaves if they would fight for the American cause.
Give me an overview of the enslaved people at Monticello and what you might see if during that time you came to visit Jefferson as a friend or colleague.
The enslaved community at Monticello was really very segmented and hierarchical. There were people who lived on the summit of the mountain, and they were better fed, better clothed, and better treated than the slaves farther down the mountain. Jefferson himself acknowledged that these people had a much harsher life than the people at the top. There was one young slave girl who was working in his textile factory on the top of the mountain. He noticed that she wasn't doing very well, that she was wasting a lot of cloth. So he said, "I have put her on notice that if she continues to waste material, she's going to be sent down to the fields to work under the overseer." That was a direct threat. You did not want to be sent down from the top of the mountain.
What were those overseers like? Was there a procession of them or just one?
There were numerous overseers. Many of them were very violent and brutal men. One man, Gabriel Lilly, beat a Hemings nearly to death, an incident that appalled one of the white workers who wrote to Jefferson and complained about it. But Jefferson kept Lilly on his payroll and said that Lilly suited his purposes better than any overseer he'd had.
A startling thing that you came across in your research was a note that had been deleted by a University of Virginia historian back in 1953. He had published the rest of the letter, but deleted a single line.
That was really the beginning of the shattering of my illusions about Jefferson running a benevolent regime. The line that was deleted referred to, quote, the small ones being whipped to get them to work in Mr. Jefferson's nail factory. His son-in-law wrote this to Jefferson, and Jefferson made no response. He did not write back and say, under no circumstances should children be beaten. He found that in 2 months of work, the nail boys could produce enough profit to pay the grocery bill for the mansion for the entire year.
Oh, he was selling the nails to others?
He was selling the nails and also shipping them to wherever he could.
He wrote to George Washington to say, "The population of slaves at our plantations is actually increasing. We are growing slaves by mothers having babies."
That's right. It was in 1792, and Jefferson was engaged in a three-way conversation with himself, George Washington, and an English agricultural expert who insisted that slave labor could not be profitable. So Jefferson sat down and composed a financial memo in which he sketched out all the different ways that slavery was profitable. And as he was writing this, he wrote down a formula in the middle of the page saying that he had noticed that his slave population increased by 4% a year. This recognition is a moment of revelation for him. I mean, he realizes that slave property is producing him a bonanza. And a few years later, he wrote to a neighbor urging that the neighbor invest in Negroes because they show a 5 to 10% increase in their value. He referred to this as the silent profit. Jefferson rebuilt Monticello in the 1790s with a slave equity loan. He bundled together 150 slaves and offered them as collateral in an international banking transaction with a Dutch banking house in Amsterdam. The problem of Jefferson's debt has been much exaggerated. Debt never stopped Jefferson from doing anything that he wanted to do. When he was carrying this supposedly burdensome debt, he built Monticello twice. Then he built another mansion at Poplar Forest. Then he invested some $30,000 in a mill and canal project on the Rivanna River. He continued to buy, you know, wines, a harpsichord, art, furniture. You know, debt never stopped him from doing anything.
What was Jefferson's policy on keeping families together, and did he follow it?
by and large, Jefferson wanted to keep families together, partly because he did have feelings of humanity and partly because it was very productive for him. I mean, he wanted these families to stay together and to reproduce. But there was a rather ugly episode in this regard, because while Jefferson was away in France, Mary Hemings, who, because she was a Hemings, was privileged, left the mountain and entered into a relationship that was a marriage in everything but name with a white Charlottesville merchant named Thomas Bell. She already had had two children with other men. And then subsequently, Mary and Thomas had two of their own children. And as soon as Jefferson got back from France, Mary appealed to him, "Would you please allow my husband to buy me and my family?" Some months later, Jefferson sent Mary the melancholy news that she could keep her younger children, but he was taking the two older ones. But he compelled Thomas Bell to purchase his own children, and furthermore, he made Bell pay a rental fee for the time that he and Mary had been living together as husband and wife when Jefferson was in France.
You've received so much praise in reviews of this book, and a few barbs from people who said, "You're just out to tear down our hero." Pulling him down, or what is called presentism, seeing Jefferson through today's eyes instead of as a man of his times.
Well, oddly enough, I didn't set out to tear down Jefferson. I set out to write a book that would examine the paradoxes and the ironies and the contradictions of the author of the Declaration continuing to hold slaves. One thing that this book expresses, perhaps, is the disillusionment of a person who once almost uncritically admired Jefferson and now stumbles across these very disturbing financial records. You can see a man who grasps the possibilities of slavery as the economic engine not only of Monticello, but of the entire slaveholding South.
Why is it important for us to understand that about him now?
I think that if we're going to learn from the past, we have to put aside this almost childish notion that our founding fathers were perfect. And I think just saying that they were flawed or human or paradoxical does not go far enough. I think we have to take a very hard-headed look at these people as businessmen and businesswomen and see to what extent they were willing to sacrifice the ideals that they themselves had promulgated for the sake of profit and power.
Henry Winsick is the author of Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves. He's also a fellow at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. For the Encyclopedia Virginia link to the letter Jefferson wrote empowering his manager to sell Mary Hemings to the merchant Thomas Bell, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. Coming up next, the daughter of Monticello.